Let's talk about women in prostitution for a minute, even though a lot of people in prostitution are not necessarily women.
Coming up, it's philosophy talk.
It's very important to defend the right to sell sex on the street.
What's the difference between selling your sexual labor versus selling your intellectual labor?
When there's a crackdown on streetwalkers, it's a crackdown on a woman's right to walk down the street wearing whatever she wants.
What's wrong with making a living from your own physical talents?
A lot of us really like men, and one reason we like the sex industry is that we get to be around men all day.
Prostitution and the sex trade.
It's much more of a two-way street than you recognize.
Our guest is best-selling author and former sex worker, Tracy Kwan.
Recorded live in Las Vegas.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry.
We're coming to you from Las Vegas. Now, what are we doing here in Sin City? We're at a very important conference, the annual Public Radio Program Directors Conference. Many thanks to our friends at KNPR, Nevada Public Radio, and our friends at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, for making this appearance possible.
Our thinking originates at Stanford University, on that part of the Stanford campus called Philosopher's Corner. That's where Ken and I are professors of philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today is the sex trade.
The sex trade, Ken, includes pornography, erotic dance, phone sex, and things that my innocent ears have never even heard of. But our focus today is prostitution in its many and varied forms.
Many forms? John, come on. Prostitution mainly involves men paying women for sex. Some variety in that.
Well, just for starters, there are male prostitutes and transsexual prostitutes too, Ken.
Yeah, but they're all in the business mostly of servicing the sexual desires of men, both the pathetic and the perverse.
Well, not all customers of prostitutes are pathetic or perverse. Come on, normal guys with normal sexual desires frequent prostitutes too. Prostitution is a complicated thing. It's a multifaceted thing. And if you lump it all together under some stereotype, we're hardly going to be able to do justice to the many moral, legal, and other ramifications of the sex trade.
Well, the legal status of the sex trade is pretty settled, John, at least in the U.S., thanks in part to the women's movement. It's been against the law since the early 20th century, except for a few counties here in Nevada.
But it's legal in a lot of countries, some of which might surprise you. Our self-righteous neighbors of the North in Canada, it's legal there. Our Catholic neighbors of the South, Central and South America, it's legal there. Religious places like India and Turkey, it's legal there. And some, which might not surprise you so much, Australia and most of Western Europe.
Well, I grant you legality is an important difference between the way prostitution is practiced around the world, but is that all you have in mind? Do you have anything else in mind?
Yes, I do. I mean, prostitutes work under lots of different social and economic conditions. Some walk the streets plying their trades in cars and back alleys. Others work in brothels, some in fancy hotels. Maybe some even in this fancy hotel. Some prostitutes live trick to trick, hour to hour. Others have secretaries, appointment books, and well-heeled regulars.
Yeah, but here's the question, John. Does any of that make a moral difference? I got to admit, buying and selling sex in any form, it feels wrong to me. It's so coercive and exploitative.
Well, you definitely got a point. Prostitutes are often coerced into the trade. Some girls end up as prostitutes before they're even old enough to really understand what it is they're doing and what's happening to them. Others are sold into prostitution by their very own families. Many are lured into it, especially these days as part of illegal immigration schemes.
And think of all, you haven't even mentioned the low-life pimps. I mean, they rake in all the profits while the poor sex workers do the dirty and often very dangerous work. It's a disgusting business.
Okay, but it sounds like it's mainly the conditions that many prostitutes work under that bothers you. But let's be philosophical. Let's consider a hypothetical. Suppose prostitutes were guaranteed a fair wage, decent working conditions, and a real measure of autonomy. Would you still find it objectionable?
You know, I think I would, John. It's not just the working conditions. I think it's inherently degrading to sell your body, inherently degrading.
With all due respect, I'm worried you're just being a prude. I mean, why should what prostitutes do be called selling their body? They're just performing certain actions for which they negotiate a fee. Why should those actions, because they involve sex, be inherently degrading? As long as someone isn't abused or manipulated, why is selling their sexual labor more degrading than selling their manual or intellectual labor?
Because prostitution debases and dehumanizes women, John. It turns them into objects. And you know what? Saying that does not make me a prude. It makes me a feminist.
Look, I do not advocate the oppression of women, but we treat others as objects in many situations. Suppose I stop and ask you for directions. I'm treating you as an object. I'm interested in you for one and only one reason. You may as well be a GPS as far as I'm concerned.
But sex is different, John. Sex should be a two-way street. Prostitution makes it a one-way street. It turns what should be intimate and mutual into something cold and mechanical.
Well, I think you're over-romanticizing sex, assuming a lot more of it measures up to a certain ideal than it does. Face it, guys get sex all the time by convincing women that they care when they don't. And I've been told this. There are plenty of women who will sleep with a guy just because he's rich or famous. Do you really think these people care about each other? At least in the sex trade, things are upfront and honest.
Oh, John, but sex is, I mean, you know, normal everyday sex, I mean.
Every day?
Yeah, everyday sex. It may be a moral mess, but it's much less problematic than prostitution, much less.
Well, I think you kind of are underestimating what prostitution at least could be. When a guy pays a woman for sex, it does not automatically necessarily mean that he has no interest in her as a person. In fact, I think a lot of guys would pay quite a premium to have sex with people they were interested in as persons, with smart, interesting, well-educated women.
Oh, God, now your imagination's running wrong. You're imagining, like, what, an Ivy League escort service or something? Get real, John. Women with options don't become sex workers. Plus, you know, your little fantasy there, it's all about the guy's pleasure. Your make-believe, premium-priced Ivy League whore is still a sexual commodity to be bought and sold.
Nice word, Mr. Sensitive Feminist. Sex work does not have to reduce women to so-called whores. I don't see why it has to. Not if it's a fair commercial transaction. Such transactions, it seems to me, could preserve the dignity of both the prostitute and the customer.
I just don't see how there could ever be such a thing in reality. But you know what? I admit there's lots to think about here. And to give us even more food for thought, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to take a look at sex work around the world. She files this report.
The act of trading sex for money varies depending on where you go. So we looked to three different cities, starting in Japan, where women can work as hostesses. A few years ago, USC sociologist Racel Paranas went undercover as a migrant Filipina hostess in Tokyo. Now, hostesses are kind of like professional flirts. Paranas says the flirting didn't come naturally for her.
Like you would say, oh, you're so good looking. Oh, I'm so excited to be sitting next to you. Oh, you arouse me. Like, it was hard to get used to this because you're acting, and I'm not a very good actress, I must admit.
The Filipina club was known for its lively, funny women. Other houses, like the Russian club, were known for very sexy women, but the job is basically the same.
You have to, you know, show a sense of servility, so you have to, like, bow down at him. You have to, like, wipe his hands. So you're really kind of just, like, flirting while you're serving him.
Perena says customers were not allowed to grope the hostesses, but they were sometimes verbally abusive, insulting the women and cussing them out.
Being a professor and then having that identity completely wiped out and then doing this work where man had these assumptions about you that didn't even, you know, recognize at all that you could be this educated person.
Perena says the women never directly exchanged sex for money, and the work was often better than what they could get elsewhere. Most Filipinas living abroad are domestic workers, so Prentice would ask them, why not do housework?
This was probably the funniest response, and the response many of them gave me, they would say, look at me. Do I look like a domestic worker? I'm so pretty. I don't look like a domestic worker. And then they would say, I'd probably get raped if I was a domestic worker.
Closer to home, if you drive down International Boulevard in East Oakland at dusk, you'll see them. Dozens of girls in skimpy clothes, standing alone or in pairs, waiting for customers. Nola Brantley has helped hundreds of such girls through her nonprofit organization called Missy. But it's the failures that Brantley cannot get out of her head. There was one girl who for years was sold for sex by her mother and her mother's boyfriends.
Our first referral on her, she probably was 14, maybe even younger than that, maybe even 13.
Throughout her teens, the girl was constantly getting arrested for prostitution. She was in and out of Missy for years. But by the time the girl was 17, she was showing real signs of improvement.
And before we can get to that place where she can really have, you know, that change and really kind of ever experience life, like what life is like to live life, this young lady slipped away because she was murdered. She was murdered, and she's an example of one of those girls that we couldn't keep safe.
Brantley doesn't really like to talk about it, but she was also sexually exploited as a teenager by a police officer in San Francisco. So she can relate to these girls, and most of them have a lot in common. On average, Brantley says, most start sex work around 12. They're usually Black or Latina. They've often been abused.
I mean, what do you think this would look like if this were Caucasian females that came from middle-class backgrounds? I mean, it just wouldn't look like this because it wouldn't be happening. We would have the National Guard out here. Seriously.
Matthias Vernaldi is 53 and lives in Berlin, where sex work is legal. The first time he went to a prostitute, she was wearing a silver mask and high heels. He says he found it cold, mechanical, and exploitative. He thought, this is not for me.
Above my nose.
But my hormones were stronger than my principles, so I tried it again. And with the woman who came to me then, it worked straight from the first time. The chemistry was right. We saw each other every few months and for years thereafter.
Vernaldi was approaching midlife. A long-term relationship had recently ended, and he had just moved to a new city. And by that time, he was also paralyzed, except in certain parts.
My muscular atrophy had progressed to such a state that I could no longer satisfy myself. So my friends and my assistants encouraged me to try it with prostitution.
Vernaldi founded an organization called Sex Abilities that connects severely disabled people with sex workers who are willing to satisfy their particular needs. And members swap advice, like which brothels have wheelchair access. Vernaldi says for him, it's not just about sex. It's about companionship, intimacy, even romance.
It's about libido and the possibility for someone to regard their body as beautiful and to see it in a sensual exchange with other bodies.
Vernaldi sees sex as a fundamental human right, something that's not always easy for severely disabled people to access.
And the immoral aspect of prostitution is not prostitution itself, but often the conditions under which it occurs.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. Along with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor, we're coming to you from Las Vegas, Nevada, a state where prostitution is legal in a number of places.
Our guest today is a columnist for The Daily Beast and The Guardian. She's also author of the Nancy Chan novels, including the best-selling Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl. Please welcome Tracy Kwan.
Thank you for having me.
Tracy, you once worked in the sex trade. Now you write about it. You write novels, you write scholarly articles, and you advocate on behalf of sex workers. Can you tell us just a little bit about your journey from sex worker to thinker, author, and advocate?
Well, first of all, it's the wrong way to frame that, because they were all happening at the same time for me. I was never in just one category. From the moment that I started working in prostitution, I had a really political take on it. And I was always curious about where did I fit in the history of prostitution. I was very young, so the way I thought about that was, you know, the way a teenager would. I had some very naive ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So in Caitlin's piece, we heard from different voices from the sex trade around the world. Now, tell us what factors you think make the biggest concrete difference in the day-to-day experience of actual working prostitutes.
That's a huge question. So the first thing is, where do you come from? If, let's say you're illiterate, that's a very basic thing. You have a little bit of an advantage if you can read and understand what the laws are. Sometimes people enter the industry, they don't even know what their legal rights are. Forget about not knowing what's legal or illegal. They may not have access to that kind of citizenship information.
Some people think just the illegality of it makes a huge difference, that making it illegal makes it worse, makes it different, because you're living against the law, you're living undercover. I mean, do you think that's a big difference or a small difference?
Up to a point, but what's really important is really knowing what the law is. And for example, in New York, I've encountered people through the sex workers movement, I've encountered sex workers who are just doing manual sex, and they actually think that they're not breaking the law.
Right.
So it's important, you know, and then they get arrested and they're a little surprised.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Public Radio Program Directors Conference in Las Vegas. We're talking about the sex trade with Tracy Kwan, author of Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl.
Would a person with other options ever freely choose to become a prostitute? Do people become prostitutes or get involved in other kinds of sex work only when they've kind of run out of other options, when they're coerced or deceived into doing so, or do people with real autonomy make those choices?
Sex work, free choice or last resort, along with questions and comments from our lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Tracy Kwan, a columnist for The Daily Beast and The Guardian. We're talking about the sex trade. Now, Tracy, a lot of feminist philosophers argue that prostitution always involves coercion, some kind of desperate bargain. It's a last resort. So the choice to become a sex worker can never, ever be one that an agent would freely, autonomously make. I tend to agree with that. What do you think?
Well, these professional feminists are generally people who don't work with their bodies. They don't understand what it's like to make a living with your body.
Okay, they don't understand what it's like. What do you mean?
They would consider it degrading because there's a kind of bourgeois prejudice against the use of the body to make a living. You're above somebody else in the social caste system if you use your mind, if you sit at a desk, if you wear a white collar rather than a blue collar. And sex work is body work. You can't get past that. It's work you do with your body.
Elites may have looked down on people who earn their living with their bodies.
Yeah, may have, yeah.
But I don't know if it's quite fair to put our feminist philosopher friends of a certain persuasion in that camp.
Totally appropriate.
They wouldn't necessarily think that soccer players, that was degrading, or that cleaning houses, they might go out of their way to say that's not degrading, it's honorable work and should get better pay.
I don't know about too many feminists who are defending domestic work as a happening thing. There actually is a tradition of equating housework with sex work and saying that they're both very valid work choices for women, and of feminists disagreeing with that.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't call it the feminist line.
There are many feminist lines. Here's a feminist line.
Sure.
Look, prostitution is driven by male desire, almost exclusively. Uh-huh. It's also driven by male economic power, almost exclusively. It's part of a patriarchal system that turns women. Mm-hmm. It's not about this mutual satisfaction or anything like that. It turns women into objects for men's pleasure. Now, how could you, I mean, I mean, it's driven by male desire, and it's funneled by male economic power.
It's much more of a two-way street than you recognize, Ken.
Explain that to me.
Well, I would say that what is offered is certainly driven by male desires, but what is delivered is very often more driven by what the sex worker wishes to share with the client. In other words, it is a very nuanced give and take. There's often a lot of hype in terms of what guys are being offered, and sometimes the anti-prostitution types fall for the hype.
Well, but wait a minute. Okay. You say there's often a lot of give and take. Those 12-year-old girls in the street, mm-hmm. in Caitlin's piece, they don't have much power to refuse, to say, I'm going to give you this but not that, do they?
But you can't be arguing from a property necessary property.
I want to say that the street is often used as some kind of argument against the sex industry, and the default is that the indoor sex workers are supposed to kind of fall for that and say, oh, no, we're not streetwalkers. In fact, it's very important to defend the right to sell sex on the street.
Why?
When there's a crackdown on streetwalkers, I mean, you were talking about women's rights. It's a crackdown on a woman's right to walk down the street wearing whatever she wants. And that is actually what pulled me into the sex workers movement, is the streetwalkers who were so radical about defending our right to sell sex.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the sex trade with best-selling author Tracy Kwan. We're in front of a live audience at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference, and we got some questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Sue. I am from our fair city of Sin.
Okay.
It's not so much of a question, but at the beginning of your talk, you addressed the idea of male prostitution and tranny prostitution, but you have seemed to proceed it in a fashion that involves women solely. So I'm a little bit curious about if you guys have experience or if you have experience dealing a little bit more with male or tranny prostitution and how that equates to the conversation that you're having.
That's really a question for you.
I've actually had experience with a male prostitute. I'm a little surprised to hear myself talking about it because I wasn't planning on it.
Well, but I'm not quite sure what was behind the question. You're wondering if it's essentially different from female prostitution?
It seems impossible that it wouldn't be essentially different.
I think the position Ken was taking in the intro was that, look, I mean, it's a very, we're talking here about male prostitutes, not about the even rarer situation in which females hire male prostitutes. Most male prostitutes are hired by men. And I think the idea is that, well, you can't cover everything, so let's look at this dominant syndrome, which applies to both, which is that males have desires and other people, mostly females,
right,
are willing to pay to satisfy, or willing to get paid to satisfy.
I think that's changing. I think she made a really important point because, yes, for a long time it was about men making more money than women and things like that, but as we know, people are talking about the fact that more women get college degrees, that women in their 20s do not necessarily go into a workforce where the men earn more money. Sometimes the girls in their 20s have to support their boyfriends and maybe even cater a little bit to the guy's ego, over the fact that they earn more than their husbands and boyfriends. So I think we are going to see a big change in the sex industry over the next 30 years.
So I still want to go back to this hypothetical that John proposed in our opening. You know, I object to the conditions under which many prostitutes have to work. I don't know, haven't taken a census whether it's most, but, you know, the streetwalkers, the pimps, all that, it seems just disgusting to me,
right,
to tell you the truth. But maybe I sound moralistic, but I want to go back to this hypothetical. Suppose you could correct for all the conditions and you could give autonomy, fair wages and all that. On what basis would an autonomous, free, rational person with other options...
Well, are you saying I was not rational when I decided to be a sex worker?
How old were you when you decided to be a sex worker?
I was 14.
Well, yes, I think you weren't.
I was pretty damn rational. Yeah. I was more rational than a lot of people older than me.
Wait a minute. I can't very well
who chose correct, other
crazy
professions.
On facts, but I think there is a distinction there, at mm-hmm. least insofar as your fictional character goes, Nancy Chan.
Okay.
She had her first paid sex when she was 14,
uh-huh,
but
13.
That's not necessarily when she decided to become a sex worker. So you might say that a 14-year-old under the influence of an older neighbor and protesting against her parents, maybe they're not fully autonomous, but this woman in the book makes the decision over and over again. And it's hard to argue with the autonomy of the person that's presented in their, I don't know, mid-20s.
You know, and autonomy is a shifting thing. We're never fully autonomous, and most people are never completely at zero level. We're always kind of negotiating with the world around us. Sometimes we want more autonomy than we have.
I'd like to go back to this thing that Ken mentioned before, because I think this is a very interesting point there. Ken was upset, or his philosophical persona was upset, mm-hmm. because the sex worker, by and large, male or uh-huh. female, is doing something because the some male wants them to
right.
or needs them to. I just want to say, welcome to the earth.
But
it's dominated by males, most of whom are... What's the word? Pricks.
Pathetic or perverse.
Yeah.
First, I don't...
And we all fit into it in various ways, from professional football players to prostitutes, so that can't be what makes it
well, it's the... No,
bad.
It's the power... It's the male
desire
driven by male power that forces women into something that they wouldn't otherwise do. I mean...
I just don't agree.
You don't think it's male power?
Let's talk about women in prostitution for a minute, even though a lot of people in prostitution are not necessarily women. A lot of us really like men, and one reason we like the sex industry is that we get to be around men all day. And I've met sex workers, women who leave the sex industry, and they're freaking traumatized because they have to deal so much more with the politics of being in a workplace where they're not dealing with as many men.
Well, that's an interesting take. We'll mm-hmm. take some questions from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben.
Thank you. My name's Chloe Veltman. I'm from San Francisco. You're talking a lot about autonomy versus power. And in San Francisco, we have a pretty legendary brothel called the Lusty Lady,
okay.
Which is interesting because it's a cooperative. And so the women who mm-hmm. work there own the brothel between them and run the place themselves. A peep show, sorry. But, you know, it's, again, we're talking about sex workers. And
yeah.
I was just sort of wondering whether the moral compass changes when, you know, you don't have this whole hierarchy of pimps or whatever and those power structures that are often kind of controlled by men.
Well, I think there's a misunderstanding about pimps. I mean, pimp is a kind of dirty word. It's a very emotive word. And people use it to describe somebody related to the sex industry that they don't approve of. And so there's often a lot of ethnic stereotyping. But, you know, sometimes people really want a manager. They want a middleman. They want an agent. They want someone to be an intermediary. It's dangerous to work by yourself. It's dangerous to work alone. A lot of the really, really bad things that happen through Craigslist happen because someone just runs an ad and has no idea and has no middleman.
But I think the question was getting at something profound. I mean, okay, if the pimps are mostly males, so I have friends, female librarians, uh-huh. and most of the managers in the library world are males,
uh-huh.
right? So the power, even though it's a female-dominated profession, the power is with the males. This is the question of whether there could be a kind of women in control of this industry, women bonding together.
There are plenty of madams and managers who are women.
Yeah, and there are, the collective in San Francisco may be a peep show, but there are definitely prostitution collectives in Amsterdam and throughout Western Europe that are run by the women.
Right, and does that question, does that make something. A moral, does that make it different qualitatively or not?
Sometimes working in a collective is more stressful than working for a manager, as many people have experienced in all kinds of collectives.
So I should point out that the Mustang Ranch up near Reno went into bankruptcy and for a number of reasons ended up being run by the federal government.
Really?
And I don't know if that made a moral difference,
so
but they still weren't able to make money.
We've got our first mammal questioner here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Dan Stock. I am a student at UNLV, and we've talked tonight about human trafficking within prostitution, and we've also talked about STDs. Do you think that regulating it and legalizing it would cut down on that? What are your thoughts on that?
Sometimes that's true, but I think that we can overestimate the benefits of regulation, and that sex workers often do a better job of regulating themselves. Some of the nicest managers I've ever dealt with were madams who were operating illegally, so, you know, and they were nicer than a lot of people working in legal industries.
So do you think, I mean, lots of people...
A lot of managers in legal industries,
lots, there's another line that says, look, you will make prostitution better for the prostitutes if you legalize it, because you can regulate it, you know, inspections, health certificates, all... You don't believe that? Or I hear you're not believing that.
Yeah, I'm not as convinced of that as some people are. Maybe I have a little bit of a bias against excessive government regulation.
Yeah, I think you do have a bias, like kind of like the meat producers who say, oh, you know, we'll self-regulate in the grocery stores. You know, there's a lot of experiments running out there now. There's all these countries in Western Europe. They're not perfect. They haven't removed all of the negative affect of being a prostitute. Women still... often ply their trade in a city, you know, a couple kilometers distant from where they live. They're embarrassed by it. But in terms of STDs, in terms of the violence and drugs being connected with it, I don't think there's much doubt that they do a better job than the very nearby European countries that haven't legalized prostitution, just based on my reading, which is extensive.
So, as far as working conditions, I just wanted to say that in New York City, which is where I've spent most of my working life, there's a lot of sex work that is quasi-legal. There have been legal decisions about fetish work, about S&M. And the fetish workers choose this because they don't want to be breaking prostitution laws, and sometimes the working conditions are worse when it's legal. Sometimes the black market economy is fairer.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This time we're talking about the sex trade with leading sex worker advocate Tracy Kwan.
Should prostitution be legalized? Should it at least be decriminalized? Wouldn't that be better not only for prostitutes but also for society at large? Or would it just make things worse by sanctioning the objectification and degradation of women?
We're coming to you from Las Vegas with an audience of public radio program directors, students and faculty from the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, and our listeners from KNPR Radio. We'll take more questions and comments from our lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. The New York Times bestselling novel, Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, was written by our guest, Tracy Kwan.
Tracy, we're going to start this next segment by having this little experiment. We're going to make you czar of the worldwide sex trade. Everything from the Avenue in Oakland to the high-class call girls in New York City to whatever goes on in India and Turkey. Your word is law. The United Nations and all the nations have to follow the policies you set up. So, what will they be? And will they be the same the world over, or do we have to take individual cultures into account?
Well, we don't want the current situation where the U.S. dictates to a lot of other countries what their prostitution policies should be. That often leads to violence against sex workers, most of whom are women. And we were talking about 12-year-old girls. Let me go micro for a minute. You know, in New York State, where I live, prostitution is illegal. Trading money for sex is illegal. And we have an appalling situation where young women and girls as young as 12, 11, 13 are charged, arrested for prostitution and threatened with conviction. Now that's crazy. And I would like to see an end to prostitution laws, if only for that reason, because this doesn't work.
Well, you want to see an end to arresting those girls, but don't you want to see an end to those girls being lured into prostitution?
Right, but what I want to explain is that the laws against prostitution, I mean, I just want to give this one very concrete example because it's something that we're working on in New York. When those girls are arrested, the idea, theoretically, is to get them to testify against the pimp. In fact, it romanticizes the pimp, it makes the girl feel more sympathetic towards somebody who might be abusing her, makes it harder for her to deal with the abuse. Criminalizing the exchange of money for sex has not ever helped to solve any of the problems that you are legitimately concerned about.
So you'd be for decriminalizing it, but how about licensing it, as it's done in a lot of countries, so that there can be health checkups and things like that?
Well, I think that it's important for sex workers to have access to health care. You know, instead of thinking of health care as a form of regulation or punishment, think of it as a resource that sex workers sometimes have trouble getting their hands on.
Okay, so I want to say something that John accused me of being a prude. I don't think I'm a prude. I really do think this is a kind of feminist line. So one way of thinking about prostitution is that it's just, at heart, a commercial transaction like any commercial transaction. You sell your labor, you sell your intellectual labor. John wrote a book, you sell that. You wrote a book that took a lot of intellectual labor, you sell that. You sell your manual labor, somebody, you know, mows lawns or digs ditches. And prostitution, just another economic transaction. And the badness is the stuff that surrounds it. Clean that up, and it's just like any other economic transaction. I want to challenge that idea. I don't think it's just like another economic transaction, because I think your sexual agency, as people call it, has a different connection to you as a person than just your manual labor or something. Your sexual agency is part of yourself. And to sell that is to sell yourself.
What if somebody accused you of projecting the Protestantism of your youth and the Catholicism of your undergraduate education onto life in general?
Well, they might be right, but I think there's some deep grounds for that. And what is sex in a human life? What is sex for in a human? To use an Aristotelian term, what's the telos of sex? What's the purpose of sex? Intimate relations between two people who are equal, and it's a reciprocal thing, and it's mutual. I mean, it's a cool
thing.
So
would you outlaw masturbation?
Could I respond to that? I mean, I think this is a really interesting argument that you've got going, but I want to say that in the sex workers movement, one of the big arguments is not about that. It's a left-right dispute. We've got people saying it's a labor rights issue, we want to unionize, and we've got other people saying it's a free market issue, we don't want unions, we want to be part of capitalism. So that's where, for me, that's where the real argument is taking place.
Well, I understand that. Let's take some more questions from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hello, I'm AJ from UNLV. My question is more along the lines of, apparently we all have different opinions about this, and apparently there's different, consequences of different policies concerning should we legislate on it or not. And I was just wondering if, for any of you, whether that fell in the gray area of just live and let live, or whether this is something we necessarily have to do something about.
I think you raised one very interesting point. There's this anthology here that's pretty good. It's edited by Jessica Spector. It's called Prostitution and Pornography. Philosophically, our attitudes towards these things, or our policies towards these things, are a bit of an indefensible mess. Pornography is basically legal because any attempt to infringe it is thought to be a violation of free speech. But in pornography, you have your disgusting male population creating a situation in which women get hired to have sex for money, but they're filmed. I read something somewhere where a single house in San Fernando Valley, or a single neighborhood San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, that one house was being used for prostitution. The police came there. The house next to it was used to make X-rated movies. Police didn't bother it. So I don't think our thinking about all this is very clear, and the live and let live seems to have kind of gotten a hold in pornography, but not yet in prostitution.
Let's take more questions. Welcome to Philosophy Talk now.
Hello, my name is Amy, and I'm also a student of UNLV. My question is directed more toward the guest speaker. It seems that you're speaking largely on behalf of women that or individuals who choose this profession. What I would like to know is, how do you feel about people who don't choose this profession, who are trafficked into this industry, and what resources do you feel should be available for them, and who do you feel should be advocating for them?
I think they need to be able to advocate for themselves. Like, they need access to a lawyer who can defend their rights.
I don't necessarily believe that a 12-year-old that's trafficked into human trafficking, right, who's being sold as a sex slave, has right, the ability to stand up for themselves and find a lawyer when they have their families and their friends trafficking them into sex slavery.
Right.
So I feel like that's somewhat of an ignorant standpoint, because how do they stand up for themselves? How do they speak on their own behalf?
No, but I completely agree with everything you say, except there are laws against coercing 12-year-olds, kidnapping 12-year-olds, getting 12-year-olds to come here and do any kind of work through a false immigration scheme.
That's a situation
So why is the sex thing the key you focus on, as opposed to the abuse of minors by people that have no right to be doing that?
And in a situation like that, a conscientious and very principled human rights lawyer is what that kid needs.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Hi. My name is Chris. I'm from UNLV. I just want to ask a quick question. Culturally, we've looked at prostitution in ancient Rome as something acceptable back then. In Gilgamesh, they look at the holy prostitute as something that civilized man... guess my question is, for each of you, briefly, how do you think us as a modern culture should look at prostitution? Like, there was Pretty Woman that came out.
I bet you can guess my answer, which I think is going to be different from Tracy's answers, which is going to be different from John's answer. I think we should look at prostitution as an expression, as an outgrowth of patriarchy, of male desires shape and male economic power shaping an underground economy to the disadvantage of women. And one way you could say, well, that's kind of, if there is this male demand, then why shouldn't women be able to satisfy it, right? Because there's a market for it. That demand creates a market. But I think that market is a debasing market, and one should limit the power of you shouldn't just let markets do whatever they want. Markets reduce workers to mere appendages if you just let them go. So the markets are not the moral arbiters of all goods. So I think, that's what I think, but I bet you guys think something very different.
Well, I don't think children should be forced into any kind of labor, or anybody should be forced into any kind of labor, and we should try to give people all the options they want. And I think an enormous part of prostitution as it exists in America today would violate that. For example, in California, there's a tremendous number of massage parlors with girls from China and Korea and lesser from Japan and Thailand and so forth. Who didn't know what they were getting into, whether they were 14 or 16 or 18. They didn't know what they were getting into. They thought they were going for an arranged marriage or some kind of job or internship or something, and they ended up, their passports were taken away from them. That's got to stop. It's terrible. But what that has to do with saying that a woman who chooses to fit herself into this crazy, stupid, man-run, debased world we live in by selling sexual activity for money shouldn't be allowed to do it is beyond me.
Let's take this last question. Welcome to Philosophy Talks here.
Hi, I'm James Hall. I'm a student over at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And my question was that you brought up earlier that you think prostitution is somehow degrading, that it ruins the autonomy of the woman. But philosophically speaking, from an existentialist perspective, doesn't it seem strange to say that no woman ever actually enjoys the work that they do? Doesn't it seem strange to say that no woman actually can live a fulfilled life or live an authentic life by doing the work that she actually desires to do?
I didn't say that no woman ever enjoys it. I mean, if you read the Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl, it tells stories of women who love what they do. But that's a different issue. I just think if you could have this ideal in which you X'd out all the degrading factors Right, and then you just let it run. But I just don't believe you can do that.
But let Tracy respond.
Yeah.
I think, you know, work, you're talking about something very interesting here. I think work is one of the most important things that we do as human beings. It has a lot to do with our sense of identity and who we are. And it's also the case that we very often misunderstand each other's jobs. If you haven't done that job, you just may not know what goes with it in terms of, you know, all the emotional baggage. And so we often scapegoat other people who do jobs that we aren't ourselves doing.
Yeah. Okay.
Recently, I saw a guy at the Democratic National Convention saying he had switched parties because the Republicans were scapegoating public service employees. I mean, a lot of people in our society feel scapegoated and misunderstood because of their work, and prostitutes are among those people.
Let's do a philosophical thing, kind of a Mills methods. Let's take two cases. One case is described by a roving philosophical reporter, this fellow in Germany. So let's take cases of prostitutes who are selling their services to disabled people who have no other possibility of affection or intimacy. And they're doing it for money, but they are proud of their work. They, I don't know, give oral sex or penetrative sex, whatever works. I can't help but think that that's a good thing. These are needy human beings, and these are people who chose to help them in a certain way, and they get compensated for it. And let's take clear a girl in Oakland, a 14-year-old girl, been forced into prostitution. That's a terrible thing. That's an immoral thing. Now, what do those two things have in common? Prostitution. So that can't be what makes the one wrong and the other one right. So that seems to me the kind of fallacy that underlies a lot of the thinking.
Well, that's a good closing thought. And Tracy, I'd like to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Tracy Kwan. She's a columnist for The Daily Beast and The Guardian. She's author of the Nancy Chan novels, including the best-selling Diary of a Manhattan Call Girl. This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page, and you can follow our tweets on Twitter.
And you can get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org. Now we're going to turn to a man who will do anything for money. Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it was Rudyard Kipling who first characterized prostitution as the world's oldest profession. But how can that be? Prostitution involves the purchase of sexual services. The purchaser needs to have money for that, so the first purchaser must have had a day job of some kind. Maybe hunter-gatherer wasn't considered a profession back in the day, and sure, there may have been ancient prostitutes who sold their services for mammoth steaks, a wheel, or a cup full of fire. But prostitution is old enough, that's for sure. The epic poem Gilgamesh, considered by some to be the oldest piece of writing on earth, has a prostitute. A hunter discovers a wild man in the wilderness and sends in a temple prostitute to tame him with sex. He enjoys the sex, but discovers that animals don't like him anymore. And who hasn't been there? This whole temple prostitute thing got me going to the internet, where I found a crackpot economic theory that kind of made sense. The theory is that money itself was actually invented to pay for temple prostitutes. 3,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, it seems, farmers would bring wheat to the temples of Ishtar. The priest would accept the wheat and give each farmer a coin called a shekel, which means bushel. The farmer would then give that coin to a temple prostitute, a.k.a. avatar of Ishtar, have sex with her, and through the symbolic act of procreation, help ensure that the land remained fertile. Over time, this practice became secularized. In ancient Greece, I read, prostitutes were the only women even allowed to handle money. Recently, in the banks of the Thames, an amateur archaeologist with a metal detector found a coin preserved in the mud for 2,000 years. Its face depicts a sex act. Experts believe it was used by Roman soldiers to pay for sex. Now, back in the days of the American Wild Wild West, saloons and brothels thrived around mining camps. When a saloon patron paid real cash for his whiskey or service, the owner gave change in tokens he had made himself and only good in that saloon, keeping the precious cash for himself. Brothel tokens are now a collector's item, genuine ones fetching hundreds of dollars. Today, of course, we use money that isn't really money in all sorts of ways. Subway tokens, online transfers, discount coupons, monopoly money, casino chips, gift cards, credit cards, bank transfers, credit default swaps, scrip and school fundraising drives, vouchers. So maybe I don't understand prostitution, but what I really don't understand is money. The most famous prostitute is probably the Book of Revelation's Whore of Babylon, who I assume did not accept tokens. Why would she? She was already decked out with gold, stones, and pearls, with her golden cup full of abominations, and, of course, the filthiness of her fornication. This great whore had written on her forehead, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Now, whatever you think of the whore of Babylon, you have to admit, that's one hell of a tattoo. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Dave Becker, Dave Bisecker, and our friends from UNLV and KNPR. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Carola Kreitmar, Caitlin Esch, Dave Millar, and the Playtones, Merle Kessler, Amy Kessler, and Joshua Raul Brody.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.